This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Get the accelerator. The place is on the water, but you say, hit the accelerator.
When disaster strikes and governments can't help, people boil over. From Athens, we talk with foreign correspondent and climate security analyst Peter Schwartzstein. His new book is The Heat and the Fury on the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Then, why are scientists still talking about 1.5 degrees of warming as the goal when last year was already hotter than that? We ask leading researcher Christoph Bertram to explain his team's more realistic take. Meanwhile, Appalachia and Nepal are reeling from city-breaking floods. Las Vegas is still sinfully hot in October. Sorry, United Kingdom, you drew the never-ending rain card in the climate casino. Who's next? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Can climate extremes drive unrest, riots, or revolutions? A journalist with years in the world's hotspots just published a new book, In the Heat and the Fury, on the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Our guest is author Peter Schwartzstein. Peter is a widely published journalist and environmental consultant for a number of big-name UN and aid agencies. After 5 years reporting from Cairo, and then 10 traveling around the Middle East, he is a research fellow for the Nonpartisan Center for Climate and Security and a global fellow with Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. Peter Schwartzstein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be here.
When first presented with the idea of climate and violence, I thought of crime rates going up in the big cities during hot, humid days and nights. But this book is not about that. How would you introduce the theme of your new book?
This book is an attempt to lay out, particularly to the casual reader, but not just, the extent of violence that climate change is already fueling globally, but also the precise nature of that violence. I mean, a lot of the time, even among friends of mine engaged in other parts of the climate discourse, there can be a tendency to think of climate-related violence as some sort of hypothetical future threat. And what I've tried to do through these many years of reporting and through these sort of 300-odd pages is to illustrate that this is very much a problem in the here and the now.
In 2015, climate scientist Colin Kelly published a paper in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They found climate change doubled or even tripled the likelihood of the severe drought that occurred in Syria from 2006 to 2010. That, they say, set the stage for the Syrian Revolution of 2011, their Arab Spring. Does your experience on the ground in Syria support that climate connection?
It does. I mean, for any of your listeners that are perhaps heard of the kind of climate security field, as it's most commonly known, it is perhaps kind of in the context of Syria. And I mean, I'm sort of just to take a sort of brief step back. From about 2013 onwards, the early-ish years of the war, there was a kind of tremendous sort of back and forth in certain parts of the scholarly community about the extent to which climate change contributed to the hostilities that triggered the initial revolution. Off the back of my years' worth of work in Syria and many of its neighbors, I fall very much on the side of the fence suggesting that climate played a relatively significant role. That said, I suggest that climate's contribution was perhaps a little bit different than that espoused by many of my scholar colleagues. One of my big takeaways off the back of this 11, 12 years worth of groundwork is that we're underestimating the nature of climate change's contribution to violence because we're not fully factoring in how climate change is acting on other drivers of instability, such as corruption, such as misinformation, such as inequality. And in the case of Syria, you had many of these farmers who had to contend with years and decades worth of bribe-seeking demands from agricultural and other officials at the time when kind of climate-related drought was massively depleting their yields and shrinking their already pretty miserly-looking incomes. the very fact that these officials were coming back to them with those same corrupt bribe-seeking demands was something of a bridge too far. They simply couldn't afford this even less than they could in times of superior agriculture. All of which is to say, yes, there was a very definitive climate component.
As you know, two social scientists and an environmental statistician argued there was no clear link between climate change and the uprisings in Syria. Professor Jan Selby at the University of Sussex found, quoting him, no sound evidence that global climate change was a factor in sparking the Syrian civil war, end quote. They don't discount a climate link. They just say it's so complex you can't find the signal. And I think it was just an early call. And as we get more extreme events, we're going to have more test cases. Where else did you find links between climate changes and violence?
So, I mean, this book is sort of an exploration through nine stories, nine case studies, one set primarily in Sudan, one set primarily in about four or five different countries of Africa's Sahel region, one in Jordan, one in Iraq, one in Bangladesh, and so on. I mean, to pick you up on the Bangladesh one for a moment, it was while I was working in a very peripheral, out-of-the-way coastal parts of Bangladesh that I, in a completely unsolicited manner, came across many of these fishermen who were being kidnapped on an extremely regular basis by pirates, by these sort of bandits that kind of ply those jungle inland waterways. And the more that I kind of dug into this issue over the course of a number of trips to that part of Bangladesh, the more that I came to understand that there was a pretty strong climate component to this cycle of violence, like basically due to sea level rise and an array of other climate and wider environmental troubles, large numbers of farmers are being displaced from their land. And the only, in their case at least, sort of viable local financial alternative is to turn to fishing. And basically, the more that the number of fishermen increases in those jungle waterways, the greater the volume of pirates, many of whom derive their living from kidnapping for ransom, these sort of any unfortunate villagers that cross their path. And just as the volume of lucre increases, more and more of these criminals are willing to deal with the unpleasant living conditions that come with coastal piracy.
So when rains don't come or floods wipe out a planting, how can agricultural failures help radical groups like ISIS?
A lot of it is to do with the kind of immiseration and poverty, which a lot of the time can give something of an opening for these occasionally well-resourced non-state armed groups or jihadists like ISIS to kind of step into the brink. But even more of it is not so much related to an increase in poverty. We know that immiseration is absolutely no kind of straightforward leap to any form of kind of criminality or violence. But when people feel that their government is not coming to their aid or is abandoning them or is distributing assistance inequitably at their time of greatest need, then that can contribute to pretty intense degrees of resentment, which many of these jihadist groups, in the case of ISIS, are pretty well practiced in harnessing.
Peter, what do you see as misinformation on the subject of climate and violence?
Well, I mean, there's sort of a few different ways to approach that. First of all, we have a lot of misinformation within these conflict climate settings, which is exacerbating the degree of violence. So, for example, if we look at the farmer-herder violence, which is mushrooming across large parts of the African Sahelian region, a lot of it is propelled by online fake news of the sort that kind of thrives in settings where authorities are kind of weak and distrusted. So, for example, a lot of the same herder, same ethnic groups from which many of the herders are drawn from are at least partly involved in various forms of kind of terrorist or jihadi activity in that part of the world, too. However, there's been a lot of either accidental or kind of willful attempts online to present these jihadi groups as being almost entirely constituted full of herders or people drawn from kind of herding-centric ethnic backgrounds. And that kind of conflation has really contributed to even more intense levels of kind of anti-herder sentiment and the kind of privileging of farmer interests over those of the herders.
Well, maybe the case for climate and violence is more regional. I mean, we don't expect riots or attempts to overthrow the government from the disaster-torn Appalachia after the hurricane. They know help is coming. But there was a massive heat wave in May of 2023 in Sri Lanka, and the starving people there, who had a lot of other difficulties, knew no help was coming from their bankrupt government, and that is when it boiled over into an uprising. Your thoughts, Peter?
Two things here. First of all, you're quite right that most of this kind of violence, most of this violence that's emerging in part out of climate change, is indeed something that we're seeing in poorer parts of the world. But as we perhaps can get into a little bit later, and as I sort of try and tilt that in the latter chapters of the book, we are seeing variations of climate-related violence beginning to play out in our own kind of richer parts of the world, too. So it's a little bit of a kind of watch this space. But as for the Sri Lanka situation, yeah, it's when you have the sense among people that they're living in hopeless situations, that they're living in circumstances where due to either climate stresses or a whole bundle of other kind of unrelated issues, that the future holds very little in the way of promise. That's where you quite often get these sort of wild, possibly irrational, kind of misdirected kinds of rage that so often kind of burst out in revolutionary scenarios. People are often acutely aware that rising up and burning police stations or kind of expressing themselves in various ways is exceedingly unlikely to lead to superior outcomes in the future. But when you're as bedraggled and as beaten down by your circumstances, a lot of the time you're not really thinking about the future. You're more propelled by a sense of desperation and kind of a desire for revenge against targets, kind of clear-cut and others.
So the United Nations just warned again about increasing violence against women after disasters strike. Women are forced to move with their families, sometimes into shelters or camps. They become targets. We are just sorting out the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, but with so few homes insured, there's bound to be loss and social stress. I wonder, does your book consider when violence is not visible social unrest, but hidden violence at home?
I do indeed. I do in a number of parts of the book look at violence against women, who, as you very correctly identify, quite often suffer first and suffer most at times of climate stress. And again, this is very much not just a poor part of the world phenomenon. I mean, in the aftermath of Hurricane Beryl in Texas in June, July, there was an enormous uptick in calls to women's shelters in the Houston area. So I do look quite a lot at some of the slightly more nebulous forms of instability that are arising in part out of climate change. And by that, I mean things like the deterioration, the decrease in perceived legitimacy of many states that are struggling to deal with climate stresses. So, for example, when you have governments, as in large parts of Africa, as in Nepal, in the case of the example that I arrow in on the book, when these authorities are kind of systematically failing for large climate-related reasons to provide sufficient freshwater access, sufficient sewage disposal, at least satisfactorily good infrastructure, a lot of the time that's going to kind of blow back in the form of quite fierce degrees of anti-state sentiment. So if we look at, for example, this epidemic of military coups across parts of West and Central Africa over the past year or two, I would argue that the very fact that so many of these often rogue or roguish kind of generals and colonels have been able to launch these assaults on either democratically elected or non-democratically elected civilian government with tremendous popular support is a reflection of the extremely broad degree of unpopularity that these authorities have brought upon themselves, in part due to their failure to provide those most basic of services. So this is to my mind, the real coming storm, and one that threatens countries that go beyond perhaps the usual suspects.
Yes, what does your book have to say to readers in the United States, Canada, or the UK, or even Australia, about why we should care about this issue? Maybe this is something that happens to other people first.
It does indeed happen to other people first. I mean, the reason why most of the book is focused on the experience of poorer countries is that climate-related violence is almost always a marriage of climate stresses and poor governance, and both of those phenomena manifest themselves most obviously in poorer places. But first of all, as we ought to have learned with the migration crisis, with varying degrees of terrorism and other troubles over the years, crises in one place do not remain as little self-contained disasters. They explode outwards. So the more that kind of poorer parts of the world with a kind of lesser ability to adapt to climate stresses, the more that they suffer from these kinds of violence as described throughout the book, the more that we too will suffer the fallouts and perhaps the uptick in populist politics that tends to thrive off threat or perceived threat around our peripheries. But to go back to what I was saying about violence against women, bit by bit, as our own climatic conditions and in some instances perhaps our own degrees of governance come to resemble those of poorer parts of the world, we too are starting to experience forms of climate-related violence. I mentioned, again, violence against women, but a kind of moderately less tragic example for the time being, but one that might form something of an eerie prelude to what we might see much more of in the future. In Greece, where I live, there's been an absolutely huge increase in the price of olive oil over the past 2 or 3 years, in large part due to climate-induced drought in Spain, Italy, Greece, the countries that produce most of that commodity globally. And the higher that the prices go, the more incentivized that criminals, including quite a lot of organized crime outfits, are to target olive oil depots and even some olive trees themselves. And there's been this massive surge in theft of large quantities of olive oil because people are now sufficiently incentivized by that high price to turn to new forms of crime.
Radio EcoShock, Alex talks with climate security author Peter Schwartzstein.
And you became a non-resident fellow with the Center for Climate and Security in Washington, but this is almost a new field, the climate security expert. As records for extreme weather continue to be smashed all over the world, what is climate security?
Oof, that's a difficult question. You're right to say that this is a relatively new field, or certainly one that's sort of growing at a pretty swift trot over the course of the last few years. But part of it comes with sort of trying to recognize how, the biggest part of it comes with recognizing how intimately connected climate stress and security are. So this can take the form of the kind of work that I do, just trying to illustrate how much violence globally is already being caused by climate-related stresses. Equally, it can take the form of trying to kind of better safeguard militaries to deal with the complications that climate change will pose for their own operations, for their own infrastructure, for their own capacity to effectively operate in different landscapes. And it can also mean everything from ensuring that regular communities, as with many of those affected by Hurricane Helene in the southeast of the U.S., are better prepared for the humanitarian and development and at the moment even aid consequences that come with intense climate stress.
Well, I wonder, do you think the Pentagon or the German Federal Ministry of Defense have in-house experts on climate security now?
They very much do. I mean, in the case of the Pentagon, the Navy especially has a very strong claim, having been one of the first institutions globally to recognize the full extent of climate change's contribution to infrastructure destruction, but also of the many different ways in which this is going to affect them down the line. And a lot of that's kind of grounded in pretty massive budgets that these forces often have. But a lot of the time that's because they are strategic planners. They understand that they need to assess both current and future threats to their capacity to perform any manner of functions. And the more they've done this work, the more deeply concerned they've become.
Well, repeated climate disasters not only cost lives, they tear away infrastructure built over decades. We certainly saw that in the Appalachians. What can be done to help stable societies and governments survive and keep on operating even during greater climate changes to come?
I try to kind of keep a little bit of a kind of sort of optimistic subtext to a lot of the book. And that key bit of sort of relative optimism is that most of the violence that I describe in the book is not inevitable. Like, this doesn't have to happen. It most certainly doesn't have to happen on the scale that is probable if we continue to allow warming to kind of continue at its current trot. In a way, the profoundly unhelpful, almost trite-sounding response is we just need much more meaningful climate action. With every kind of small incremental increase beyond the 1.2 or so degrees Celsius that we've warmed thus far, it becomes that bit harder to maintain viable communities in which agriculture can allow hundreds of millions of people to live becomes that bit harder to gird governments and rural and even some urban communities for extreme weather events coming their way. So, I mean, this boils down to an extremely familiar refrain. We need to wean ourselves off oil and gas as swiftly as possible for reasons of violence prevention, amongst so many others.
We talk about institutions. You are one of the few with one-on-one contact with real people on the harsh side of climate change. Tell us a couple of human stories from your book on the front lines of climate violence.
So a lot of the work that I've done, or perhaps the country in which I've done the most of my work, has been in Iraq since about 2013. And that's because I was doing years' worth of work trying to better explore how ISIS profited from collapsing agricultural conditions to bolster its ranks. And I interviewed quite a few captured ISIS prisoners of war, an inordinate number of whom had been farmers from some of the kind of most drought-battered expanses of Iraq and Syria. And one of these individuals in particular spun this sort of long, self-serving, but as far as I could see, essentially accurate tale about how, as drought conditions kind of replicated themselves year after year, and as his sort of anger at government increased due to his perception that it really ought to be helping him at his and his family's time of greatest need, it really only came to that point where he was just fishing around desperately for any kind of alternative at a time where he felt the Iraqi authorities had sort of abrogated their right to govern in his particular kind of climate-battered part of the country. Equally, in the Sahel, this other large part of Africa in which I do a lot of work, I've encountered so many of these farmers and herders who are kind of competing for scarcer degrees of kind of adequate pasture land. And for many of them, most of them, they really don't want to fight. I mean, despite the sort of misinformation that I invoked earlier, a lot of them do look at one another as sort of friendly peers. But circumstances are such, along with strong degrees of poor governance, that circumstances really are pitching them against one another. And this is just a tale that we're seeing more and more from pole to pole.
And what are you working on these days?
Well, I'm sort of busily whoring myself out trying to get the book out there. I mean, to my mind, there's very little point spending this volume of time writing a book if I can't get it in front of people who are hopefully in positions to do something about it. So to that end, I've done a large number of briefings to different U.S. government officials and yesterday and the day before to their U.N. equivalents in various agencies in New York, and I'll be doing something similar in parts of Europe for much of the month of November. But thereafter, much of my work has taken me to very hot, often arid parts of the world. And particularly when I've been working on challenging, quite sort of psychologically taxing issues, I've kind of forever retreated to mountains as a way of sort of doing my writing, kind of restoking my batteries ahead of the next kind of delve into a sort of challenging landscape. So I'd like to kind of write something, either a novel, though despite writing as a living, creative writing is such a different animal that I have absolutely no idea how to go about that. Or perhaps a kind of non-fiction book centered on the ways in which mountains are changing in a kind of more climate-battered future.
Well, as the climate heats up, both people and plants and animals are going to be moving up into higher altitudes, into the mountains, so that's going to change that whole dynamic as well.
Very possibly. But then again, and as you know well, I mean, to look at some of the worst destruction that Hurricane Helene left in its wake, a good chunk of it was in the kind of mountainous parts of western North Carolina. I mean, areas around Asheville that were quite frequently described by various U.S. magazines as a sort of possible climate haven away from coastlines that look to see to be that bit more vulnerable. And as we are seeing, mountain ecology is by its very nature acutely vulnerable to even small changes, and really perhaps hammers home what so many of us suspect, which is that there will be very few, if any, sort of genuine havens if warming continues at its current trot. So this is a problem that must be addressed head on. There's simply no running away from it.
From the Center for Climate and Security and the Wilson Center, we've been speaking with climate security journalist and advisor Peter Schwartzstein. And you can travel with him to dangerous places in his new book, In the Heat and the Fury, On the Front Lines of Climate Violence. Find my notes and links to follow up in my blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Find Peter at pschwartstein.com. Peter, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
When it comes to climate, the mountains have always been an attractive place to live, and now even more so with climate change making severe weather events even worse elsewhere. Climate change leading to climate migration.
Weather events are becoming crazy all over the world, and there's places where they're less crazy. Asheville's fortunate to be one of those places.
Now more people taking refuge in the temperate mountains of western North Carolina. This real estate broker is saying he's hearing that climate is a big reason why people are moving here.
I think people have noticed and are moving here to escape wildfires, to escape floods, to escape hurricanes, to escape droughts.
Scott Shuford is a local expert in community planning and resilience.
Our big three issues of climate change affecting North Carolina are sea level rise, which clearly we're not having a problem with that, but also heavy precipitation and periods of drought.
He says those don't affect us in Asheville as much since we're far from the coast, have the North Fork Reservoir for our water supply, and the elevation to keep our temperatures mild. Not immune to climate change, of course, just less susceptible. And he doesn't think we're anywhere near the peak of climate migration.
This is one of the most ironic clips ever. WLOS 13, Asheville's ABC affiliate, ran that piece on why Asheville is safe from climate change. It was in April 2022. At the end of September, 2 years later, Asheville was partially destroyed and cut off from the world by the tail end of Hurricane Helene. There are no havens from climate change, you know that. You may lose life expectancy inhaling wildfire smoke from fires thousands of miles away. Or you may be evacuated suddenly and shocking when it comes to you. This is why all of us, young and old, urgently need to become climate communicators and activists. We will be right back with answers to the infernal question, why are scientists still talking as though limiting warming to 1.5 degrees C is possible? Time for climate news tidbits. If you are in Vancouver October 16th to 18th, drop by the 2024 Coal Association of Canada Conference. Their slogan is, Canada has what the world wants. Climate-killing coal, I presume. They have charts and experts to show expanding populations around the world need more Canadian coal. You can even learn how Canada expanded two coal ports in Vancouver to ship coal from the open pits of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming on Warren Buffett's coal trains. Seattle and the other U.S. coast cities refused that dirty business. Coal is not fading away, no matter what you hear. Global coal prices and production are up. I'm sure the industry is happy to stay out of the limelight as continuing disasters strike, due in large part to the coal industry over the last 200 years. Hey, Vancouver, time to turn out on coal again. A new study finds about 40% of the public supports rationing measures to fight climate change. Well, sure, maybe in Sweden, where the study came from Uppsala University. Actually, they say the new study involved 9,000 people in Brazil, India, Germany, South Africa, and the United States. This is surprising. It turns out millions and millions of people are already deeply worried about climate change. They're willing to help, maybe even give up a little, but only if the system is fair to everyone, not just the 1%. You can find a link to that in my blog.
Warm and rising waters in the dark. Hold on tight, tight. Hold on, thousand. Hold on, thousand deep. Hold on, stone in the stone. Hold on, 2 years of rain.
Sail
This